I'm Nikki Nolan, and this is Matter of Life and Debt, a show about people in the United States and their student debt. Today's episode, Successful Loan Cancellation. I talk with Kim Baker, an associate professor of criminology at the University of Northern Iowa. She shares her experience navigating the temporary expanded public service loan forgiveness system. And, to my surprise, she recently achieved student loan cancellation. This is her story. Welcome to the podcast. It is so good to have you here.
Thank you. I'm excited to be here. I actually, when I very first heard the first episode that I listened to, I was picturing myself talking to you. So it's kind of fun to be here.
That is so exciting. Yeah, we found each other through Twitter and your story is super interesting and we're going to get into that. But first, we're going to get into the thing I ask everyone. How much student debt do you have right now?
Right now, I have none. And that's a new thing. I would say it still hasn't totally sunk in.
I am so excited to get into this because I think when we were talking last time, I think you still had some debt, maybe. How much debt did you have?
I originally took out about $140,000 in federal loans. I had $10,000 in a Texas state loan program. And then I had, we'll talk about it later, I'm sure, but I also had some of my sister's debt, and that was probably about $8,000. So that was everything all together. And I paid off the Texas thing and my sister's thing. And then my federal debt was just canceled. I guess now about 2 months ago is when it all sort of started to happen. And I had $131,833 canceled.
We are absolutely going to get into all the details of how you did that. But yeah. Before we do, what has been the impact of student debt on your life?
Mostly, I was always aware of it. I was always thinking about it. I recently said something to my spouse about how this is so exciting because now if I were to die, you don't have to pay off any of this debt. You wouldn't have to put life insurance toward it. None of this would be yours to deal with. And he looked at me rather horrified that I would get like that I even thought about my death. But I was just, no, this is something I thought about was leaving you with this monster. And it was all accumulated before we were together, but I don't know what all the rules are. And it was, that's the extent to which I thought about it. I didn't have a retirement account until I was 37 because I moved to a state that had a state pension program. So that's the first time I had any kind of retirement. I only have ever really traveled related to work and then sometimes tack on something extra. But I've never just taken a trip. And then my mom got really ill a few years ago. She had early onset dementia, and she went from full-time employed preparing for retirement, and at 62, she suddenly takes a turn. And by the time she's 64, she's in a nursing home. And she's been in a nursing home for, I think, about 5 years now. And she's in Texas, and I'm in Iowa, and I can only visit once a year. That's all I can afford. So just the debt was just this thing that just stood in the way of being with my family and doing something interesting and planning for my future and really being kind of the adult I thought I would be. It really held me back.
Yeah.
And you did an interview with Melissa Byrne where she talked about changes to higher ed funding under Clinton and especially changes to the student loan system. And as she was describing it, I was like, I didn't realize all that was happening. Like, I didn't realize how my story is just right at that time that higher ed funding changes and all of a sudden they take the caps off of student loans and they let people borrow as much as they can. But also in that interview where she talked about her experience with Reverend Jesse Jackson, where he told her not to hide her debt.
Mm-hmm.
To say the numbers out loud and to recognize that it's not a personal failing, that it is a reflection of an unjust system and we need to call it what it is and we need to name it with our numbers. And that was the first time that I really started actually looking at my balance and I started saying my balance out loud to people. And it was a little embarrassing at first. But it was helpful. People who were in a similar situation were like, oh, I know that. but also people who really didn't understand the scope of the problem were able to see the problem for the first time. I mean, I paid for 10 years. I paid every month. I paid on time. Mm-hmm. I paid a little under $60,000, and my balance went from 140 to 131,000.
Wow, it went down though.
I did make a dent in my principal, mm-hmm. but also I'm a white woman.
Yeah.
Right? Like the research is showing that I'm actually in a better off position, as terrible as it is, that I actually am getting to my principal. And if I hadn't had cancellation, honestly, I mean, it would have been tough, but I would have been able to pay it off, right? Mm. I mean, I would have paid for another 15 years.
Yeah.
But I would have paid it off, right? Mm-hmm. That is not true for, particularly for Black borrowers and especially Black women who have higher levels of debt, have often debt that is much more out of alignment with their income, who never get to the principal, right? So I feel like the fact that I got cancellation and the fact that I actually chipped away at my principal a bit is a reflection of the privileged position I have. It's not a reflection of, oh, hey, this is good. I did something good, right?
Yeah.
This is a structural situation that is unjust. And all evidence is showing us that cancellation will benefit borrowers and especially will benefit Black borrowers. It will boost the economy. Right? Mm-hmm. I look forward to spending money. I look forward to saving money. Mm-hmm. Right? To the extent that we want capitalism to function, this is part of how to do it.
Full agreement. I'm curious, did it help? I know it was embarrassing at first to start saying the numbers, but how do you feel it impacted your life? I think a lot of people feel so much shame, and I'm curious about that with you. What was your experience like?
Well, I think several things happened at the same time. So my friend Louise Seamster, who's at the University of Iowa, does work on debt and race, and some of her work is specifically on student loans. And so she was encountering her work and seeing her advocate for cancellation and so forth, helped me think about my situation sociologically, which, you know, you think I might do because I am a sociologist. But, you know, you also don't always want to take your work home. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So it helped me, you know, to start to look at what was happening in structures in higher ed, what was happening in student loan systems, what was happening around fluctuations in unemployment. Because, you know, I mm-hmm. went on the job market 2008 just as the crash was happening.
Yeah.
Oof. Right. And, you know, once I had a job, I was just holding on. And so to sort of look at all those systems and see those systems functioning helped me to move away from the idea that I had just made a whole lot of bad decisions. And so that helped. I also had seen conversations that I have also heard reflected in your podcast around calling it cancellation and not forgiveness. Mm-hmm. I don't need to be forgiven. Yeah. I didn't do anything morally wrong. This is a cancellation. And so then thinking about out loud, naming my debt, naming my numbers, sort of happened all around that same time. Mm-hmm. So it was a way of naming a problem rather than exposing myself. And so that helped because I had ways to talk about it that were about systems and failures and injustice and not about me, Kim Baker, who just didn't know any better when I was 18.
That was the most healthiest way for me to frame it. Tell me about your public service loan forgiveness path. I would love to learn what you did and how this happened.
A payment started in 2009. So just on math, I would hit cancellation at 2019. There's sort of some offsets because your loan servicers change periodically and then they put things on a pause, you know, mm-hmm. for a month or two and then it goes on.
Yeah.
But somewhere around the time that I moved here, so I moved here in 2013, and there started to be a lot more talk about PSLF mm-hmm. in circles I was following on social media and somewhat in the news coverage, because we knew we would be coming up on that first round of people who could apply for cancellation in 2017. Mm-hmm. And so somewhere, I know in 2016, I started reading a lot more, and that's when I was, oh, wait, so now there's an annual certification process, and I haven't been doing that. Mm. But also now it's very clear you have to be in this income-based repayment program. The graduated won't work. So I switched my payment plan, but that means my eligibility for PSLF started in 2016, even though I had been paying since 2009.
Oh, God.
Of course, you know, like that's how it's going to work. But there was nothing I could do about it. I was just kind of resigned to it. And then in 2017, they passed the temporary expanded PSLF. So people that were in the wrong three-payment program and then got in the right one, or a couple of other circumstances, but that had been working for 10 years and should qualify. And so I come up to 2019, and I know I'm getting close, and I start asking around, how is this going to work? And no one knows. We don't have any idea, because the idea was once that pool of money was used up, it was just gone. They weren't going to keep funding it, or there hadn't been any effort to keep funding it. So I don't know, is that money still available? I have no idea. And I remember, I know I called my loan servicer, who was MedLoan or... And so I called them, and whoever I talked to just the first person you talked to. You know, I didn't get transferred around. And they were like, yeah, I don't think you're going to qualify. And I was worried, too, if I applied and got denied, would I get kicked out of the whole thing? What was going to be the consequence? I don't know, and no one can tell me. And I had already been prepared to pay until 2026 because of this shift. And so, I just kind of left it and just kept going. And then my spouse and I, so we've been together since, I think, 2015, but we had never gotten legally married because it just wasn't important to either one of us. But around 2017, his insurance situation changed and we needed to get him on my insurance. And the only way to do that was to get legally married. And so we did that to get him on my insurance, which is good because my insurance is awesome. And also exactly a month later, he had a kidney stone that would have been very expensive had we not had good insurance. So it was totally the right decision. But putting him on my insurance is $500 a month. So a lot. Worth it, but a lot. So then I do the paperwork the next year and submit our joint tax
file. Yeah. Oh, God.
My payments are just shy of $600 a month. So, you know, it's going to go to 7 or 8, right? That's going to hurt. And it comes back and my new payment is just shy of 1100. So my payments doubled. And it was really, wow. And then, you know, the extra 500 on insurance, all of a sudden our finances got very tight. I'm not thankful for the pandemic, but I am super thankful for the pause because we were struggling. The pause in student loan payments in itself was a relief to direct money other places. But then I actually heard your interview with Hill Kamen, where he describes his experience with temporary expanded PSLF. And his story had a lot of similarity to mine. I knew because he had gotten cancellation fairly recently. I was, okay, so that pool of money still exists. So check. And then he also talked about how he had to just try over and over again. And he had to keep calling and he had to really hold his ground to be able to get through the whole process. And that was like, I now understand I'm going to have to battle. Like, okay, I can do this. And so in April of this year, I submitted my application. I knew from Hill that I would apply for PSLF first, get rejected, and then reapply for temporary expanded. So I was like, okay, got it. That's fine. So that was in April. And then, but even with that second one, I applied on April 27th, and on April 29th, I got a rejection. And no explanation for why.
Yeah.
Just said you don't qualify. I applied a total of 4 times. Every time when I would call, I was often told it was something with my paperwork. Somebody had scratched out a date and put in a new one, but not initialed it, or a signature, a person, the way they wrote their name. They wrote a shortened version of their name, but they signed to their full name. I don't know. I keep asking, I'm sorry, can you fill out this paperwork again? Sometimes I couldn't even tell which school had the problem, so I just submit both. And at some point, because I had been on auto pay since 2009, so all my payments were direct debited, and I had not changed banks.
Yeah.
So, you know, I had never had a disruption on my end. And so I know I have made these payments. And so I attached a spreadsheet. Here's every payment I have ever made. Here's where the pauses are. Here's where my changes in loan services are. Here's where I change my payment plan. I know this to be true. And I attached that with my application and I still get a rejection. The last one I got it was the first time they declared I was actually in the temporary expanded PSLF program. So I had been admitted to that program. I had two different loans because one was the standard student loan and one was one group that mm-hmm. was consolidated with the standard. And then the other group was the graduate school stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I paid one payment, but it was broken down into two separate loans. And when I get this paperwork for a temporary expanded, it says I have 87 qualifying payments on one loan, but 96 qualifying payments on the other loan. And I was like, I just take one payment. This doesn't make sense. But that was odd enough for me to finally get past the first line of service. Finally got transferred to a specialist. And that's where I had a specialist who is awesome. I have his name written down. I say thank you every once in a while. But he was like, this seems weird. Let me go back and look in the documentation. And then he also, I loved it. He would mutter out loud about what he was seeing. And so he found that, so first there was Mohela, who was my servicer back 2012-13. When they directed my payments, they would direct my payments to one loan and not the other.
Wild.
So even though I'm just making one payment, they were paying one and not the other. And so that's why my number of payments was different.
Mm.
Oh, Aspire then had months where in the same monthly record, it would say I missed a payment or I was late on a payment, but it would also say I was an auto debit. I'm an auto debit. I'm not late and I'm not missing it. But it would say that in the same record. And he was, we see this all the time. Like both of those things. He's, I've seen this before.
Mm-hmm.
But I couldn't do anything about it. He had to, it turns out the office that makes the decision about whether you get cancellation is totally separate from this office who figures out these kind of problems. And they don't communicate unless I call and I manage to get through this to the specialist line and I get somebody to do this for me.
Mm-hmm.
So he then communicated to this other office, hey, this needs to be reviewed and here's the documentation. I have no documentation that this communication has actually happened. It's just all in a black hole on my side. And I have no way to hold anybody accountable for any of this stuff. So I'm just waiting. And he was like, it's going to take a month or so be patient.
Mm-hmm.
But luckily it didn't. And so on July 26th, I got a letter that said, I actually got three letters on the same day, said I have met my required number of payments. In fact, I've overpaid and that my account is going to continue to be reviewed. And then on August 20th, so almost a month later, I get a call that says the Department of Ed has approved my cancellation through TEPSLF. And then everything happens pretty quickly. So by August 23rd, I have a zero balance. When I sign in, I can't sign in through the phone app anymore. They won't give me access. But it honestly, it happened, but I was like, is this real? What does this mean? I still got a couple weeks before I pay bills. What's that going to look like? Because mm-hmm. I've been having on my list of bills, I have the, my student loan was there, but I just had a line through it, waiting for the payments to resume. And then September 3rd, I get a letter out of the blue from my loan servicer that says that my application has been reviewed and that I do not qualify for loan forgiveness.
Oh my God.
Yeah. And so I was like, what? And of course the letter, because, they put the letters in, but they just push out notices at midnight.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't call. What is happening? My balance still says zero, but what's happening? And I call them and I need the specialist office. I'm not dealing with the frontline stuff anymore. Get me to a specialist. And the specialist is just mystified. He's like, I can't find any reason for this letter. Your account is closed with us. And he's, the only thing I can think is that one of your previous applications didn't officially get closed out.
Oh God.
This was just them officially closing the loop. And then it just out of practice, it generated this letter. But I don't know. So I can't get an answer. And then meanwhile, I am a member of the union strike debt. I have several friends and contacts with some other organizations. So I posted about this on social media and immediately was getting, you know, I was getting advice from different people. I was getting some potential contracts with attorneys and that kind of stuff. And they were, you know, one person was, you know, this sucks, but my Fed loan is going to end their contract with the federal government to do this stuff with loans in December. So basically once a month from now till March, just check in and make sure your balance says zero. And if not, then, you know, we need to get you in touch with an attorney. So it's just, it was okay. So it's canceled, but now I got to sit in this limbo. And fortunately, somebody from SBPC contacted me with an ombudsman at the Department of Education. And it was through the ombudsman's office that I was finally able to get confirmation. So on September 23rd, she sent me an email saying that I can confirm that your loans are discharged and you have nothing to worry about. And that's coming from the Department of Ed.
Okay.
Even if my Fed loan tries to say I have a loan, the Department of Ed, who actually holds the loan, says I don't. So that's the first time that I was like, okay, this is all a fluke and I just have to let it go.
Wow. What a nightmare.
But I really, other than just describing it, I have no adjective that adequately captures how absurd and also painful that 4 months was from when I first applied to when it finally happened. You know, meanwhile, there are headlines circulating that, you know, the PSLF program, it's not working the way it's supposed to. And that 98% of applicants have been denied. And then the Department of Ed is saying, well, people are applying when they don't actually qualify. And I'm like, no.
That's not what's happening.
Loan services, which have had no oversight for well over a decade. And also, why the hell are we farming this out to private companies rather than the Department of Ed, who is responsible for this, actually doing it themselves? Your companies are making mistakes in people's records with enough consistency that the person who went to look for my problem found it in under 10 minutes.
Mm.
You have a loan servicer problem. You do not have a borrower problem.
Yeah, pretty consistent.
Yeah, I did when I worked with the ombudsman. You know, I provided her with lots of detail and lots of documents. She actually had worked at SBPC and lots of people had told me she was really good and reliable. So, I mean, thank God I'm not dealing with DeVoe's Department of Ed. Because
no.
I think I still would not have cancellation. But there are some good people now that are trying to make this situation better. Of course, you know, last week they've finally announced new rules and they're going to try to be more generous. I think we should cancel it all.
Yep.
It should just all go. It should all go. We have an unjust system for financing higher ed. We need to fix how we finance higher ed and we need to start over completely.
Mm-hmm.
While I think people, if they qualify in any way under the new rules of PSLF, I think they should absolutely go for it and apply and get through the process. But it's not enough. I mean, it's not like my parents could have paid and just didn't. We were poor. We could not afford it. I started college in 1994. In 2021, I was still dealing with this.
Mm-hmm.
It's unjust.
Yep, it's totally unjust. Wow, what a wild ride. I want to know more about your story.
So I grew up pretty poor, but I didn't know it. In my early years, my family was on the path to being middle class. And then the recession of the 80s hit. And my dad worked for Texas Instruments, and he lost his job somewhere around the time I was in second or third grade. And then my dad was actually never full-time employed ever again. And it's not something I fully understand, and he's actually passed away. So, you know, it's not something I can really ask him about. but, you know, I think it was personal issues for him combined with massive structural issues. But my mom, you know, in those early years, my mom was a stay-at-home mom, and that had always been her dream. And that's what she thought her life would look like. And then it just so happened that as he got laid off, she managed to get a job as a secretary. And they decided he was on unemployment. And for that first summer, he was going to stay home with me and my sister. And then my mom, as a secretary, was our only income, with sporadic income from my dad, for well over the next 10 years. We stayed in the same home. Before all of that happened, my parents had been able to get a mortgage. My mom has a college degree. She went to college to find a husband. She called it the MRS degree. She was very disappointed to graduate with a degree rather than a husband. And so then my mom kept us afloat, but we never had insurance. So I knew we didn't go to the doctor regularly. We only went for an emergency. The house was never full of food. You know, sometimes utilities were out, but my mom would play it off as, oh, silly me, I forgot, I'll take care of it. It's just the world I lived in, and I didn't fully understand the depths of the situation that we were in. But all that meant that my family had no money for college. That was not a thing. But at the same time, there was a lot of pressure to go to college, because college was going to be my way out. My mom tried marriage. My mom thought marriage would be her way out. That didn't work. And so the next thing was college. And I went to a pretty good school for junior high and high school. So everybody around me said college. I was in honor class and stuff. You go to college. And my mom had a small amount of student debt from her college years. But I think her payments were somewhere around $70 a month. And I remember when she paid them off, because we did a rare thing and we went out to dinner with that next month's payment. So it was a big event for us. But, you know, $70 a month, even in the 80s, was a manageable amount. And so my mom was just like, you know, so you'll take out loans. It's not really a big deal. You know, they're low interest. It's fine. And so we start getting ready for my senior year. I start looking at schools. And it just sort of was a mix of things that, with the scholarships that I got and considering the cost of living and everything else, I actually went to a private school. I went to Texas Christian University, which is in Fort Worth, TCU. But it was cheaper for me to go there than to go to the University of Texas, which was the other main place I had been admitted and was planning to go to, because the cost of living in Texas in Austin is so high. And I didn't get as much in terms of scholarships. And also, this was 1994, so Texas was starting to defund education, so the cost of college was going up. And the other thing about TCU that I didn't know, that I now know very well, is that at private schools, they tend to give you really generous financial aid packages that first year to get you in the door, and then that financial aid decreases over time every year. This still happens everywhere. It's happened at every private school that I have ever been a part of. But I didn't know that then. So I actually thought I would go my first year and it would get cheaper because I'd get more scholarship. I'd keep applying. And I didn't track things, so I can't tell you for sure exactly what happened. But I do know, I remember getting that next year's financial package and being like, huh? That doesn't seem right. So the other thing that happens at the same time in my senior year of high school is that my parents divorce and my family kind of disintegrates. My mom gets a new job and moves to a new town. The new job comes with better pay, which is excellent. And she actually has a real turn in life circumstances around mm-hmm. her new job. She got a job working for the federal government in an administrative assistant kind of position. So benefits and all kinds of stuff. But, you know, there was no saving for years and years. So it's not like that money could go towards college. Then you fill out your FAFSA and you get your student aid report and it says your family contribution is X and it's based on my mom's new income.
Oh.
But, you know, she's paying off a decade of debt from all the stuff that had happened the years before. So, yeah, I basically took out loans for anything I didn't get a scholarship for. I was an RA through college, so my housing was free and my food was free. And I always had a job, you know, to help cover some basic expenses. But I just did it all in loans. And I probably graduated college with somewhere around $20,000 of loans, fairly small amounts for 4 years at a private school. But it was a real pivot point of escalating me to more debt because I was afraid to be unemployed. Mm-hmm. I was afraid because of my family history. Seeing what happened to my dad, I was very, very scared of being unemployed. And I'd never really looked for a real adult job before.
Yeah.
and I was a sociology major, so they didn't really help me think about what kind of jobs I might apply for.
Yeah.
I was just, well, I could just go to more school. I mean, if you think you need a bachelor's, a master's is even better. And so I applied to graduate school and I got in and I got a scholarship. I got a good financial package the first year.
Yep.
and it was a private school. So I got into Vanderbilt. And I got a degree. It's called a Master's of Theological Studies.
Hmm.
That saved me from having to look for a job and being worried about my loans being due and how mm-hmm. I was going to make enough money to cover them. I could just tuck them away and forget about them and then go to this new school. And yeah, I'm going to get more debt, but, you know, I'll get a better job. There is recent talk. Anne Helen Peterson has done a nice series of articles on this topic, and a couple of other people, predatory master's degrees.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know then that's what I was getting into, which is a master's degree that's usually simultaneous to a more prestigious academic or professional degree. So I was in the Divinity School at Vanderbilt. Divinity School is where they train ministers, but it's a college within a university, and a seminary is a standalone school. It's not under the university umbrella. So within a divinity school, which is people who want to be ministers, they take that program. And then they had created this thing called an MTS. It's a Master's of Theological Studies. And it's all the same stuff, but without, you know, all the work in a church to actually become a minister. So without the practical work. But that also means, now I know, it has absolutely no application. It doesn't lead to any kind of job.
Wow.
And Vanderbilt, I don't even know what it was then, but somewhere probably around $45,000 a year, which is an extraordinary amount of money. But at the time, everybody's like, loans are no big deal. College debt is good debt. Interest rates are low. Your payments will be low. It's okay. So not a single person suggested I pause and think about this.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody that I talked to was, this is amazing. Keep going. I got there and I very quickly knew it's not the right place. But I also, I'm not a quitter. So I didn't just stop. And again, I'm afraid to just drop out because then my loans start being due and I didn't have a job plan. And so it was very intense therapy for being raised as a fundamentalist because Vanderbilt is super progressive school, which I didn't really know. I was just going for prestige. So I applied to fancy schools. But yeah, it definitely was a 180 from every kind of religious and specifically Christian training I had ever had. And it really radically changed my belief system and kind of my way in the world. And I appreciate it a lot, but I probably could have gotten a lot of that with a really good therapist who would have actually been cheaper. So then my specialization there was, it's called HACTR, and it's Historical and Critical Theories of Religion. And I pretty quickly know I want to be a professor and I want to do it in sociology. I definitely don't want to do it in religion. I'm done with this. The New School for Social Research in New York City is how critical theory came to the U.S. The major critical theorists from Europe came over in the 30s. They were escaping the Nazis and set up this school in New York City. And it was originally just this graduate program. It now is part of the university, but at the time it was a graduate program. And so I was, okay, that's where I'm going to go. So I actually moved to New York City without ever having to then visit. I didn't know anything about it, but I go to New York City. I work full time during the day. I do my master's degree at night. It's exhausting. So I'm able to pay more of my expenses. I can't pay my tuition, but I can pay all my other expenses. I had a savings account for the first time.
Wow.
And made pretty good money, embarrassingly, initially selling test prep for Kaplan. And then I realized I can't sustain a PhD program. And also higher ed, finding a professor position, there's sort of some rules about you're probably not going to be able to teach at a school that is higher ranked than where you graduated. And the New School, while it was an amazing program, its overall graduate school ranking was fairly low.
Oh.
And so that really limited the kind of jobs I would go for. So it was, well, let me see if I can find another program. So I got into a few and I went to the University of Texas, where I was fully funded the whole time. I had maintained my residency in Texas because I had only gone out of state for school.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was still a Texas resident. And so all my funding was able to cover all my tuition. Plus, I would have various kinds of, I had fellowships or research positions or teaching positions that then paid my living expenses. And so I say that, I mean, when you total it up and look at my tax returns from that time, I was making about $15,000 a year. But if you have a small apartment and, you know, eat out of boxes and cans, you can make that work. At least then, right? That was 2002. So I only, at the end there, I took out loans just a couple of times, once to cover a summer when I wasn't funded, and once right at the end where I was, if I don't stop doing all this work, I'm never going to finish this dissertation and I have to finish. So that's how I got to over $150,000 in debt. Faculty, I think at the schools I had been at, TCU and Vanderbilt, even the new school, faculty were paid very well. So I thought I would go into my first job and it would be a windfall and I'd pay off that debt and live a nice professorly life. The other thing I didn't understand about professors is the kind of job you have makes a really big difference in your pay. So if you're in on the research trajectory and working at especially the more elite research heavy universities, often state schools and stuff, or elite private schools, the pay there can be quite good. And so my best friend, she went out the year before me and she got a job. Her first job, her offer is, I think, $70,000 a year.
Wow.
And, you know, and then I had a partner. So my partner would also have an income. So I was, we're in the money. This is so exciting, right? Like, this is coming. And I had a teaching focus. Mm-hmm. I wanted to be a teacher. I'd always wanted to be a teacher. So I go on the market and my job offers are $50,000 to $55,000. Good. Definitely more than my parents ever made. Difficult to consider $150,000 in debt, mortgage, car.
Yeah.
And so it was really, it was a big shock. It was, my spouse did have a job. Actually, my first job was at Ithaca College in upstate New York. And my spouse was able to actually get a job at the same school. But his income was also, you know, not high. So, you know, together we just kind of made it by. And the thing is with academia, so first you have to move across the country for your job. It's really rare that you get a good job that's close to where, either where you grew up or where you did your grad work. And so generally you're moving across the country, unless you're in a very elite school and most schools aren't going to give you enough money to do that. So I think my, you know, my move budget was somewhere around $1,500 to move from Texas to upstate New York. So I don't have money. Where does that go? That goes on a credit card. And then that you are expected to present at conferences. Those conferences, they're often expensive. They're in big cities. So early on, I thought I had to go to the big national sociological conference, the ASA, the American Sociological Association. Your dues are, I don't know, $250. Your registration is $250. And then you still have hotel and travel and food and, you know, whatever else is involved. And my school would give me $1,500 a year, but I was going to probably two conferences a year. There's no money to cover all of this. And yet it's a normal expectation of my job. So when I was working in New York City and have a job for the first time, that's about the time my sister went to college.
Okay.
And my sister, I don't really know exactly what all happened, but my sister ended up taking out private loans.
Oh, God. Yeah.
You know, I think the loan market had changed by then. And, you know, my mom just wasn't super sophisticated about handling it. And, you know, you just financial aid gives you the paperwork and asks you to sign it. And my mom didn't get approved as a co-signer because of her own personal debt and finance issues. And so she just called me and she was, hey, you know, you have a job. Do you mind signing this? And I was, sure. I want my sister to go to college. Look at the life I'm living. And so I co-signed her loans. Around 2009 is when my loans first come due. And unconsolidated, all my loans from different lenders, they're federal, but they're all over the place. So 2009, we know about PSLF. And I ask around about how this works and what I need to do. I talk to my loan servicer, I talked to people I know in financial aid, and everybody's like, I don't know, in 10 years we'll be forgiven. Like, there wasn't regular paperwork yet. They didn't really have a clear annual process set up yet. I remember reading online, and then also someone told me that you need to enroll in an income-based repayment program or the equivalent.
Oh, interesting. The equivalent. What does that even mean?
For me, there was a graduated payment program where the initial payments were much lower. My payments on that would have been around $350 a month. And on the income base, it was $500 a month. And so a gap. But then on graduated, it goes up. So over time, I would end up paying more than I would have paid on the income base. So I joined the graduated repayment program instead.
Wow.
People told me, yeah, that's going to work. That's fine. And then in 2010, I'm looking at my credit report and I have these loans that I don't recognize. Mm. And it turns out that my dear sister just isn't paying her student loans. Mm-hmm. And because I was the co-signer on two of them, they're on my credit report. And I didn't know that's how it worked.
Yeah.
And she just, for a variety of reasons, she just wasn't going to pay them. And wasn't going to pay them regularly and on time. And so I just took over. I can't, you know, I need this to happen. So from, I think, 2010 to 2014, I pay off two of my sister's loans. So money I can't put toward my own. Because I also had that Texas loan mm-hmm. for like $10,000. I could have paid that off early or something. But so no, I was paying off my sister's loan. And then, at least at Ithaca College, we got regular raises.
Mm, that's good.
But then I moved to Iowa. So the trade-off in Iowa is that the cost of living is much lower.
Mm-hmm.
I mentioned before, Iowa has a state pension program that is solid. And I saw that as my first time ever to have the potential of a real retirement plan.
Mm-hmm.
Because honestly, I mean, no matter how much I put in a 401k, average earning individuals can't put enough aside to pay for retirement in a 401k. Or for education, it's a 403b. So I was like, wow, a pension, and it's a good pension. If I work for 25 years, which is really close to when I hit 65,
mm-hmm.
and I get my max pension, it's really generous. The other side is I took a pay cut to come here. Ithaca College, I started at 55 and I had worked up into the 60s. And then I came here and I started at 55. I dropped that down. And then we basically don't get raises. I might get a percent, a single percent. My annual income doesn't really go up more than $1,000, except for when I get promotion. So mm-hmm. when I went from assistant to associate professor, I got a chunk there. And then I'll get a chunk when I go up for full. The good news is my spouse has ended up in a job that's much better. So now without our debt, things are starting to look different. And also, so the pandemic put loans on pause. So mm-hmm. I wasn't making payments. And so all that money I could just put toward our credit card debt.
Yeah.
We can't travel. So I don't have to pay for these conferences I have to go to. So it's sort of starting to get to a point for the first time, like ever in my whole entire life, that I'm like, I could do this. It's starting to be a new world.
Is there any advice that you would give to your younger self, knowing what you know now?
I would say to myself, one, community college and state schools are a great place to get an education, and they are less expensive, and that's a good thing. I'm a big fan of public education and I want to see it much better funded. I would see it free
mm-hmm.
or very near free. But I even in the circumstances I was in, I didn't have to choose the University of Texas. There were a lot of other smaller or less expensive state schools to choose from. So I would have encouraged myself to have an appreciation for public education and then also to be bolder. Mm-hmm. I was so afraid to look for a job. Mm-hmm. I was so afraid to leave education, which was a space where I had been successful and that was not terribly challenging for me. And I was afraid to do things that were new and hard and different. And now I'm in a job that I kind of like. But after you spent, let's see, 14 years getting mm-hmm. degrees, it's really hard to just be like, yeah, I'm not going to do this anymore. Now without the debt, mm-hmm. I'm starting to get the room to kind of imagine a different future to see what that could be like. And I have no idea. But, you know, even early on, I was so afraid of becoming my parents. I ended up financially better off than my parents. I have insurance. I have a retirement account. I can weather emergencies to a degree.
Mm-hmm.
And that will start to improve over the next few years. I probably had $40,000 in credit card debt. So being afraid and trying to make safe decisions didn't get me out of anything. So I wish I'd been bolder, even if it had just been working a couple of years and then going to grad school.
Mm-hmm.
I wish I had tried.
Well, we'll check back in with you in a year just to see what's happened. So we've come to the end. Is there anything you want to promote?
I think the main thing I want to say is that whatever kind of debt you might be dealing with, find groups mm-hmm. you can be a part of. I'm a part of Strike Debt, which is a union who currently is focused on student loan, but they have their sights much higher in addressing other kinds of debt, medical debt, and so forth. So that's one that works for me, but there are a number of different organizations that have active local chapters that are doing work around student loans. So look in your community, look for groups who are doing the work. Look online. You can find them also through social media and stuff. But find groups to be a part of, because this is not a problem we're going to solve on our own.
Yeah.
Occasionally I hear people say, I'm just not going to pay my debt anymore. You know, I'm not going to pay my loans anymore. And I'm just like, oh, that's going to get you personally into a complicated situation fast. But if you work with a group and the group is striking, the group is organizing, the group is going after the legislators and things like that, mm-hmm. it's meaningfully different and can have different consequences. So look for ways to resist. Look for ways to make change, but do it with a group.
Thank you so much for being here. It was wonderful having this conversation.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me and letting me share a lot.
Matter of Life and Debt is produced by me, Nikki Nolan. Special thanks to F.A. Ackman for creating the music and mastering the audio. Additional support and thanks to Emma Klauber, who writes the information and transcripts about each episode. This podcast would not be possible without them. Visit our website for more information, matteroflifeanddebt.com, where you can listen, read transcripts, get additional context of the subjects you just heard about, subscribe absolutely for free. That website again, matteroflifeanddebt.com. Thanks again for listening.